Welcome Committee. First item on the agenda is the uninsured driver's report, Lorna Youngs. Lorna, here this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Lorna Youngs, the manager of the DMV. And here, I'm here this morning to report on the impact of the automation of Oregon's liability insurance reporting system to see whether or not that has had some impact on the uninsured motorist rate. There was a budget note during the last session that asked us to come back and report on that since the implementation of the automated phase that went into effect in April of 2001. The program was created in 1993, essentially required that all insurers send their book of business to the DMV. They had 15 days to report new insurance policies and 30 days to report cancellations. And by April of 2001, we were able to automate that system and make it available to law enforcement through the law enforcement data system. That meant that the patrol persons had in their vehicles on their computer the ability to run a license plate and determine, even before they made the stop, whether or not that individual was insured. And in fact, it could be used as a reason for a stop should they care to do that. So we did a survey of law enforcement agencies recently, now that this has been in effect for...
Is her microphone working or is it supposed to be working?
I'm sorry.
Who's that?
I don't think people can hear what you're saying. I can't.
I can start over again?
No, you're... But I mean, the fact is, I don't know that they're recording it or what, but you...
Okay.
It's working.
Okay. Well, I'm coming off of a cold and my voice is a little scratchy, so I'll try and speak up. So essentially what we, in order to take a look at the law enforcement phase of it to see how effective a tool it has been for them, we surveyed them to determine the extent to which they're using it. And what we did discover that while they're not using it necessarily as probable cause for the initial stop, they are finding it a very useful tool to verify insurance online. And it helps them determine whether or not that individual is insured. But in many cases, people have insurance cards, but they canceled the policy a few months ago. And what this insurance system does is tell them when the policy went into effect and when it was canceled, what the electronic system does do. We have seen a slight decline in the uninsured motorist rate since the since the automated system went into effect. For the average uninsured, now the way in which most states measure the uninsured motorist rate is through the rate of uninsured motorists with accidents. It's a kind of a standard tool that most states use. It's been the most effective way to do that. And what we've seen is that in the 4 years prior to the implementation of this automated phase, our average uninsured motorist rate was about 12.5%. Since then, we are, in the past year or so, have about 11% uninsured motorist rate. The national average is about 14%, which puts us in a much better shape. And as a matter of fact, we are in better shape than most of our western states. There are only states with four western states with lower rates, Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, and Montana. So Oregon is in a pretty good position when it comes to uninsured motorists compared to the nation and certainly compared to the West. What we've also been able to do with this system is administratively make our own processes more effective. When you renew your registration, you know, on the back of the card, you're supposed to write in your insurance number. And in the past, when you didn't do that, we sent it back to you and told you to fill it in. Now we are able to check on the system and see whether or not you are insured and therefore save us the trouble of bothering you again. Those that show on the system no record of insurance, of course, we send back. We also do a random sample, and we get a certain percentage of no respondents. If we do not get a respondent, then we do cancel your license. Although the car is required to be insured, the action is taken against the license. So if you are not insured, the owner of the car's license is suspended. And now we are able to use the automated insurance system to check for those who don't respond to see who does or does not have active insurance, therefore not send a cancel or a suspension notice out to those. We instead concentrate our suspension notices on those which the system shows actually have no insurance. Now, some of them may be insured because, as I say, there is a lag time on the system, but that does make that process more efficient. And what we are also intending to do to make it even more efficient in the future is to concentrate our sampling on those records or vehicles where the automated insurance system shows no record of insurance, so that we anticipate we should get a higher rate or home in more closely on those individuals who are not insured. So the system has been useful, and we are looking for ways to make it administratively more useful in the future. And that concludes my report. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Lorna, does the motor still have to carry a card verifying that they are covered by insurance?
That is correct. You should be carrying a card in your wallet and a card in the vehicle that's showing that you are insured.
Is there any other questions? Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Woodburn, we have a real problem. About 80% of all the accidents where a Hispanic is at fault doesn't carry an insurance. Is it because they buy the used cars, pay cash, and don't, there's no way you can require them to put insurance on a used car? I mean, how are they skirting this law? I also talked to some of my insurance friends, and they say they buy the insurance, and they let it lapse right away, and there's no tracking. So how do we make sure that these people comply and that they're carrying insurance if they're going to be driving cars? Big problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, when you register a vehicle, you are required to show proof of insurance. Now, if you buy a vehicle, since registration flows with the vehicle, if you buy a vehicle and it's got a year's worth of registration on it, we're not going to know that you are insured or uninsured. Our opportunities to find out when you are insured is when you come in contact with us in terms of renewing your driver license, renewing your registration, other than the random sampling process where we send out a certain number of inquiries to registered vehicles and say, are you insured or are you not insured? So one of the ways in which we may, A, be able to resolve that issue is now that we are concentrating our sampling on those that the system now shows us do not have current insurance, we should be able to home in more closely on the folks that are letting their insurance lapse shortly after they register. Now, of course, the problem that we also face is our only tool is to suspend the license. That does not always keep people from driving.
Is there any other questions?
Well, in that particular vein, if a person sells a car to someone and cancels their insurance on it, does that pop it into your, is that something that you'll pick up then? Easier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, that is correct. Our system, the automated insurance system, should show a cancellation on that policy. What we're not, as I said, doing routinely sweeping it every time that occurs and sending out a notice. We will be using our sampling process to do that, to pick those up now in the future.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, are they printed only in English, or because Woodburn, like my city of Cornelius, has a large Hispanic population that doesn't speak English. Do they get a English, is there one printed in Spanish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, what are you referring to?
The information, like if you were sending out this sampling to one of the people in Cornelius that was Hispanic, and he or she does not read English, if it has a Hispanic surname, would they get mm-hmm. one in English and Spanish?
Representative Brown, our notices in regard to the survey are in English.
Okay. I wonder if that's not causing both of our areas.
That is.
Or in your area, Russian.
I mean, we have a tremendous amount that don't speak mm-hmm. a lick of English.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that notification would mean anything. Want to follow up?
Representative Brown.
Do you have any idea of the percentage of people who actually are driving whom you suspect do not have insurance? Because I would say in my area, a number of accidents where people simply don't have any insurance at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, our estimates based on the methodology most states use, as I said, which is the rate of uninsured motorists involved in accidents is about 11%. That's the, we've been tracking that for several years. It's been on average about 12.5. It is down to about 11 right now. So, and we'll be also looking at the way in which we can use this system to help also refine those estimates, but it'd take a few years to, but we it's the same system that most states use to determine uninsured motorist rates. We're about 11%.
Representative Zoner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding enforcement, if you pull over a car and you check and find out they don't have an insurance certificate, what do they do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zoner, that would be up to the jurisdiction as the degree to which they would pursue citation for uninsured motorists, or the degree to which they're making traffic stops for that reason alone. Each jurisdiction they can be certainly cited for being uninsured, and then that would end up with, if they could not prove insurance, that would come over to us as a suspension of the license action, and they, of course, are available to the hearing process for that. But as I say, I really can't answer for the police for each jurisdiction how they handle that.
Do you know, can they impound a car that if they fail to insure it, then and their license, you know, then can that car be impounded?
Mr. Chair, that's probably a local jurisdiction decision. And I think that impounding has been an issue that has been considered, but state law does not require that. That would probably be a jurisdiction by jurisdiction decision to use impounding as a method.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Lorna.
I appreciate the opportunity.
John Powell or Jack, would you have any comments, or do you have anything? John's got his telephone on.
I've been trying to shut it off. I apologize, Mr. Chair, because it rang, and I don't know. It's off, but it turns itself on. And I'll tell you, I'm not, are we on the third floor? Maybe if I threw it out the window and went and picked it up, it would work properly.
I can turn it off for you, John. Bring it over.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I represent State Farm Insurance Companies and North Pacific Insurance Company, who sell automobile insurance in the state of Oregon. Mr. Chairman and members, I really don't have anything to add to the report. This issue of uninsured drivers has been around the building since I've been here, and it causes a lot of frustration when you get calls from constituents who have been involved in an accident with an uninsured driver. The bottom line, and I've been on task forces on this issue back in the 80s and around when this bill passed to create this tracking system. Short of spending literally millions and millions of dollars of having people follow through and go out and take license plates off cars, manually take driver's licenses, there is no way to get to a perfect score in this arena, because people can get around it. And particularly people who have few resources are put into a real bind because of the cost of insurance, which is going up because it pays for medical expenses and other repair expenses, which are getting more expensive by the day. So it puts them in a real bind. And some people, because of that bind, find ways of getting around it. And for every way I've ever heard of stopping it, another way of getting around it seems to pop up. But clearly, people can insure a vehicle and terminate the insurance the next day. The reporting system, as DMV has pointed out, has a lag system in it. So even if they show up, there's a period of time there that it's hard to catch them. Many of these people move all the time, and they're very difficult to locate. Some of the information sent to them by mail, they may not be there to receive it. So this is just a very, very difficult subject area. And as I think was pointed out, Oregon is probably a little bit better than the average in terms of number of accidents involving uninsureds, but it is a frustration. I think North Carolina years ago spent millions of dollars to literally send people out and take license plates off cars and that sort of thing. Then you always have the situation that where some states have developed very elaborate computer systems that have failed. Arizona, I think they sent letters over a weekend to 50,000 people and told them they didn't have insurance when they were all insured due to a computer mix-up. And so some of those programs have been repealed. And so it is, we still have the requirement to carry a card, to have evidence of insurability in the vehicle is a requirement. We have the ALAR system of insurers reporting to DMV their book of business and their both terminations and additions. So probably from a practical standpoint, Oregon is doing most of what it can, given, again, as I point out, the real true dilemma some people have when it comes to paying for these coverages. And again, it's why we always oppose increasing the minimum limits on insurance. While most people buy higher limits, if you increase those minimum limits, it just makes it that much more unaffordable to a larger population.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but just when people have to choose between getting to work and feeding their families and maybe driving illegally, I think they usually make the choice to get to work. And if there's an answer, it's got to be through both affordability as well as education and trying to convince people to be responsible and do the right thing. But there's incredible economic pressure on low income people to get where they have to be. And I think if we're at 11%, we're probably not doing too bad.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just say one additional thing. It, interestingly enough, one of the television stations in Portland followed individuals who'd had their license suspended for various reasons and weren't supposed to be driving. In one case, a young fellow went into court, and the judge was very emphatic about him not driving, et cetera. He went out, they followed him with a camera, and went out and got in his car. And he said, starting to drive away. I said, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be driving. And he said, I know I'm not supposed to be, but I'm driving, and he drove off. As long as people can get keys to a car, it might not even be their car, but as long as they can get keys to it. Now, in the case where the car's where somebody does have insurance on the vehicle, it will follow an uninsured driver, even if they're involved in an accident. It defaults to the insurance on the car if the person driving it didn't have it. So the insurance on the car is always primary. But it's still, as long as people can start the vehicle, there will be uninsured people on the roads, no doubt about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, and I have this feeling that it really doesn't pertain to this, and so I don't necessarily think you need to go into it. But allowing or having insurance companies be able to base their rates on credit ratings and bankruptcies, does this have any effect?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, I don't believe it does. There have been several studies indicating that the use of credit in underwriting does not discriminate that way, and it's being studied very, very carefully and closely, and there are lawsuits and that sort of thing. Today, in fact, is the last day for us to get some comments back on rules that the insurance division here has promulgated on that, and in fact, they prohibit you from using credit to cancel somebody after they've been insured with you. It cannot be the factor that you use to cancel someone. So for the most part, those kinds of determinants are, I don't think, responsible for any certain class of people having higher uninsured rates. The other thing on the uninsured issue is that there is a, mandatory coverage in Oregon of uninsured coverage. And most people buy up on that coverage, which becomes underinsured coverage. So even if somebody with low limits hits you and you have a high limit in your uninsured motorist coverage, you're protected by that coverage as underinsured. It becomes underinsured motorist. So you're carrying a $300,000 uninsured motorist level, and somebody with $25,000 of a liability crashes into you and it's not sufficient to pay, then your coverage will pick that up. So what you're really out for the most part when you get hit by an uninsured driver would be your deductible on your physical damage side.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you required to have written permission to run a credit report?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Berger, we're required by law to tell people that we're going to run a credit report. If they say no, then the report would not be run, but they would also not be able to get insurance in that situation. But they are informed, and the rules that will be effective soon require that be done before any kind of underwriting that would involve credit would be done, that they would be informed. Then any adverse action taken based on that, they have to be given the reasons in descending order of importance as to why that action was taken. If you had written bad checks, hadn't paid bills, whatever those situations are, you're given a list of those. These new rules require that as well as a free copy of a credit report to the party involved.
Thank you. So one more question.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Right now, people, when they come in to get their insurance, they have to prove they have a driver's license. To get a driver's license, they don't have to prove that they have insurance. What if we had a rule or had some way to set up that when they went in to get their driver's license, they had to show proof with their insurance card that they had insurance coverage? Would that work? Would that
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, that could potentially create roadblocks to going without insurance, but of course they could still do the same thing, get insurance that day, have coverage, and then terminate it. Buy it for a month. You can buy liability coverage by the month. They could buy it for a month, go in and take care of their transaction, and then not renew that coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Monty, would you come forward? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Monty King. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. Our association has been working on this issue for about a year now, and we're absolutely appalled as an industry and as just citizens of the state of Oregon of how this system is working. The fact that people can't afford to have insurance should not matter at all if people are going to be on the road. If they're on the road, they have to have insurance. I personally have two cars. One has a loan on it, so I have to carry full coverage. Second car I have is a 1989 Mazda 323 with a branded title. It's worth about $800, but it runs like a charm. I don't pay very much insurance on that second car. If that much insurance is the difference between somebody driving or not driving, then they really don't have a desire to drive on our roads. From what I understand of the system is, it's costing the people of Oregon $200 to $300 million a year for the damage caused by these people. And that's just the physical damage, that's not the body count. I know a state representative who's not going to be a state representative anymore from Southern Oregon. The last three accidents she's been in have been in by uninsured motorists. The last one almost killed her son. When we talk about damage and how much our deductible is, that's not talking about the real life issue of the damage to lives. I was golfing the other day, or a few months ago, with a lady from just north of here. Her entire life has been devastated by an uninsured driver who was driving a vehicle that was not titled or registered in the person's name. No insurance. driving while suspended. Every single thing that's wrong with our system, this guy did to her, and she's probably never going to work again in her life at a real job. Those are the real societal costs of the system we have. There is, I think, a simple fix. DMV has to be informed when insurance is canceled. When a cop runs a plate, if there's no insurance, you pull the plate or you tow the car. And if it goes, and if that plate is uninsured more than 30 days, you cancel the registration on the car. And if they want to drive the car again, then you charge them a new registration cost plus fees. But this is not a nickel and dime issue. This is $500 million every biennium, and plus the body count and medical costs. Every time we've talked about it in our association, every member's meeting, I have the people raise their hand. How many people have been involved in an insured motorist accident? Almost everybody in the room raises their hand. Some of the people have to raise their hand two or three times. Two weeks ago, I did it in a room of 10 people. There were 17 uninsured motorist accidents among those 10 people. Now, I don't care what the other states have got going, but my association, my members, really would like something done, both for their businesses and for their families and for the people of Oregon trying to deal with this issue. It's if you're talking about $500 million every 2 years of losses, what's it cost in the state of Oregon in tax revenues? Because all that's deductible. So you're really talking about 50 or 70 million, I don't know what it is, of real dollars not coming to state coffers because of accidents and injuries. And again, that's not counting the body count. I'd be glad to answer any questions if anybody has them up here.
Any questions, Monty? Thank you, Monty. Okay, the next item on the 9:15 item on the agenda, Teresa Presley.
Good morning, Jason.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Teresa Presley. I'm from Presley and Sons Moving in Gresham, Oregon. I am also a Household Goods Carrier Task Force member. A task force formed by the 2001 Oregon legislature has been meeting this year to determine how to address a problem with persons acting illegally and competing unfairly with authorized household goods movers. House Bill 2817 called for the task force to include representatives of an authorized household goods mover, the telecommunications industry, the Oregon Trucking Association, the Oregon Department of Justice, and the Oregon Department of Transportation. Moving residential goods from point to point within Oregon is a regulated service, with certain companies authorized by the Department of Transportation to provide service to the public at approved rates. But under ORS 825.017, a person can provide an unregulated service packing or moving personal property if the person doesn't provide a vehicle or act as an agent for anyone who does provide a vehicle for moving the property. Oregon Department of Transportation estimates there are more than 75 businesses offering a pack and load service in Oregon today. Over the years, Oregon Department of Transportation investigators have found that some pack and loaders have done more than that. They packed and loaded household goods and provided the truck used in the move. Since they usually don't pay associated business costs such as liability and cargo insurance, they've been competing unfairly with the regulated authorized movers. To address the problem, the task force recommends the following changes in state law. Add a pack and loader definition to state law. Pack and loader means a person who provides services relating to the packing or movement of personal property but does not directly or indirectly provide a motor vehicle for the movement of the property, nor act as an agent for any person who does provide a motor vehicle for movement of the property. Remove the current exemption from the motor carrier regulation and require that pack and loaders register with the Oregon Department of Transportation, pay an initial fee and an annual renewal fee, and file proof of general liability and or cargo insurance. This would add a level of consumer protection. Require that authorized household goods movers, such as myself, pay an annual fee for administration and enforcement efforts so Oregon Department of Transportation does not inappropriately draw from highway fund dollars to run the program. The fee would be based on a percentage of each mover's revenues from transporting household goods within Oregon. Establish a special consumer protection household goods, household moves account for all fees and penalties to be used exclusively for administration and enforcement related to pack and loaders and household good carriers. In addition, representatives of the telecommunications industry have agreed to allow advisory notices to be prominently placed in the moving section of the yellow pages, telling consumers about regulations governing household goods movers. To address a problem with unauthorized household goods movers, the Household Goods Carrier Task Force recommends that businesses providing a pack and load service should be required to register with Oregon Department of Transportation and file proof of insurance. Authorized movers would pay a fee to cover administration and enforcement costs. There would also be additional efforts to inform consumers about state regulation of movers. The committee will also receive a detailed report from the task force with the proposed legislation within the next 2 weeks. It has been drafted and is being reviewed by the task force members now.
Thank you, Teresa. Is there any question?
Thank you. Teresa, I've been working on some legislation for some people within the construction industry that would ask a requirement that people working in the construction field that have to be licensed and regulated would have to wear visible ID when they're performing the services. Was that discussed with your task force, the potential for having people have to be identified either by their company or...
Are you talking about the individual moving companies themselves being identified?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we really discussed that. My employees are all in uniform. When we arrive at someone's home to move them, is that what you mean?
Well, actually for what I'm proposing is that people would have to have an ID tag with their... Now, we're talking about licensed plumbers, licensed electricians, that they'd have to have an ID tag and their picture and their license number while performing the service. But obviously, packers and loaders aren't, as individuals, aren't required, aren't licensed. But if the companies would have to be licensed, it would seem to me it'd be reasonable that people performing that service for a licensed company should have to have some type of visible identification that they are licensed by the state of Oregon to do that.
That would be nice. I mean, if it could be that way. I'm not sure. I don't think we've addressed that at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Teresa, I guess I want to be really clear about the limits of which this regulates people. If I'm going to move from Coos Bay to Portland, I'm going to have a mover that's going to come and insure my goods. I'm going to move now from 13th Street to 16th Street, and I own a truck, mm-hmm. but I'm unable to lift mm-hmm. heavy things. So I have a pack and loader come in, load my truck. I drive my truck to 16th.
Correct.
They unload it into my house.
Mm-hmm.
under this circumstance, what changes from now to what you want after legislation?
Representative, I think that what would change would be that those companies that are out there would have to be licensed with the Oregon Department of Transportation. They would have to have insurance on those men that are coming into your home, loading up your worldly goods onto that truck. You're then taking it over to the other home, and it cargo insurance, anything if they were to damage it, walls, doors. And they're not required to do that at this time. There's no requirement.
Suppose I don't care if they are insured for my goods.
Well, then
I understand that they're not, so if they damage anything, then I'm responsible. I don't have that option under this.
I believe as long as they're not bringing the truck to you, transporting the goods themselves, I believe you can hire whoever you want to hire to load up your goods into your truck while you're transporting them on the highway.
Okay.
That it's just not a couple of other men out there with a truck off with people's furniture.
So let me be very clear. They must own the truck themselves. They're not going to be using my truck, and I'm not going to be driving. Is that right?
No, a pack and loader cannot provide a vehicle.
Okay.
For
and,
the
and nor can they drive the vehicle.
I believe in Oregon, in Portland right now, and I'm not sure how it is set up down here in Salem, I believe that they can transport the vehicle from your home to your new home while those household goods are on it. But you have gone and gotten that vehicle, brought it to your home, and return it back to wherever you got it from if it wasn't your own personal vehicle.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Mr. Chair, thank you. There's an extension a little bit of Representative Berger's move from 13th Street to 16th Street. I'm assuming, based on what you've described here, that if I use my own pickup and I get the two Boy Scouts from next door to help me in return for a pizza, that they're not covered by this law.
Correct.
Or this proposal.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
Is there any other question? Okay, so we go to the next one. Is this group here? Okay, could I have, Lynn Lerbach, Harold McKenzie, and Tom Herbert come forward, please? Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and start whatever order you'd like. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Lerbach, and I'm a representative from the Joint Council of Teamsters, and that is the Oregon governing body comprised of 9 local unions representing more than 30,000 active and 20,000 retired Teamster members working and residing in our great state. I am joined by members of the International Brotherhood of Longshoremen on both sides of me, who will speak to the issues today with personal experience. And we want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. Every morning, hundreds of semi-trailer trucks begin snaking through the streets of Portland on their way to the Port of Portland to pick up an intermodal chassis with a container bound for an Oregon destination and beyond. The trucks are herded into long lines engines running, spewing cancer and asthma-causing particles into the air. When the drivers finally reach the end of the line, they are supposed to be hooked up to a chassis, a safe chassis, to take out on the highways. And let's remember, safety ought to be our first priority in everything we do, especially with trucks. This combination, a truck, a chassis, and a container, will weigh as much as 80,000 pounds. Sometimes overweight containers are also pulled by these chassis. And they're often found, these chassis, in deplorable condition, not safe for use on our public roads and highways. These are the issues my colleagues and myself are here to testify on this morning. We will discuss the unsafe chassis, our plan for a chassis roadability inspection program, and an emissions reduction program at the Port of Portland. Under current law, the brunt of responsibility for compliance with federal safety regulations or state concerning the maintenance of chassis rests with the port driver. This responsibility, however, is completely misplaced, as port drivers do not own, nor do they possess the authority and or the ability to effectuate such compliance. Rather, these obligations initiate with and truly belong to foreign-owned multinational conglomerates, steamship lines, and or the Ocean Marine Terminal. These entities either own or are officially charged with maintaining such equipment. For example, at the Port of Portland Terminal 6, more than 278,000 cargo containers are processed each year. A tour of the intermodal chassis yard where port drivers pick up their chassis, you will find rows of unsafe chassis awaiting repair. And we note here, these chassis are stored with the roadworthy chassis in the same lines, so it's very easy to mistake one for another when many times the driver, because of expediency or lack of knowledge of the port's color-coded repair system, will take an unsafe chassis. We submit that unsafe chassis should be separated and stored in a separate lot. Drivers should never have access to unsafe equipment on the property. We have submitted to the committee, I believe, don't they have them already, the Mark, did you give them all the exhibits? Should be a package of exhibits there. Thank you. And these are the types of things you'll find in the exhibits on the pictures and the list of unsafe chassis and what's wrong with them that you will find on any given day at the port. And presently, chassis are only inspected upon arrival. A port checker, who is not a certified mechanic, performs a quick walk around looking for noticeable damage. He doesn't really have the opportunity to get up under the rig. He doesn't have a flashlight in his hand to be looking for the brake system or cracks or damage of the frame. Any noticeable damage is documented, and the checker affixes an appropriate color-coded tag to the chassis indicating the needed repairs. And if you look at page 7 of the exhibit, this is the report of damaged chassis checklist used by the port checker. And I believe it's in your package there on page 7. As you will also see in the exhibits, some of the chassis are in need of minor repairs, such as missing reflector tape, which shines up in the night on the back of the chassis, while others suffer from more serious structural damage, such as a bent or cracked frame. And this is a very serious thing, as I'll speak to in a moment. In addition, note the photo of the chassis that has not had an annual inspection. Now, this is required by Federal Highway Administration regulations, and the port does not conduct these types of inspections. And incidentally, they are certified mechanics, and they're very capable and have the facilities to do so. Rather, the inspections are contracted to off-site vendors by the foreign-owned shippers. And that example, as the picture will note, this is a chassis that is 9 months overdue and is sitting in the yard. And how this can be allowed off-site is a real question of concern, especially when you consider the port has the on-site facilities. They could have performed the inspection and aren't contracted to do so by these foreign-owned shipping companies. The port presently has two qualified mechanics to repair chassis in the yard. They have more mechanics in their shop. They are not able to complete all repairs because of time limits, again, set by foreign-owned shipping companies. They give them a time limit to perform the certain repairs, and they must conform to it. These foreign-owned companies control the cost of repairs at the expense of safety, which limits the port's ability to repair chassis properly. While we hope that drivers take only roadworthy chassis, the nature of the low-paying container industry dictates otherwise. Many of these drivers, as independent contractors, are paid as low as $30 a load. Any delay at the port comes out of their pockets. So they have to get this container, go get it loaded, go deliver it, and then get back, and they do this for as low as $30 a load. With no system in place to inspect the chassis and its load when it leaves the terminal, an environment exists where unsafe chassis are operating on our public roads and highways. Drivers under time restraints can and do take unsafe chassis from the yard, endangering the driving public. Note one incident here. An unsafe chassis caused the death of 6 children when a piece of the chassis fell on the road, bounced up under a minivan, rupturing the gas tank, and it burned the 6 children in the minivan to death. We cannot allow one more death caused by anything unsafe or an unsafe chassis. There's no reason for these things. I'll speak just for a moment on the issue of emissions. These long lines at the Port of Portland facilities often force trucks to idle for long periods of time. Idling trucks emit air contaminants. An idling truck does not burn fuel efficiently. If you've been around one, you'll see when it's idling, you'll see the ugly black smoke coming out because that engine isn't performing at what it's designed to do, and it emits all kinds of contaminants that cause a health problem for residents in the area and especially the workers, the dock workers and truck drivers that have to work under a cloud of pollutants. With a current system of first come, first serve, there is no scheduling of truck arrivals at the port. This system causes trucks to line up in large numbers at the gate. And there's no incentive for the port industry to correct this problem because most port drivers, as independent contractors, are paid by the load, not by the hour. So whoever they work for or who they're working with, or even at the port, right now there's no incentive to stop them from all lining up because they want to be the first guy there to get that first container and hit the road and try to make a good living out of it or try to make a buck that day. The port needs your help. They need enabling state legislation to ensure they have the authority. That's very important for them. And that they're paid appropriately by the shipping, these foreign-owned shipping lines, for maintaining an efficient inspection, repair, roadability program. We propose that this legislation requires ocean marine terminal operators to implement an intermodal chassis roadability inspection program to certify that chassis have been inspected and approved prior to being released for operation on public highways. In addition, any citation issued for the violation of any state or federal law related to the defective condition of an intermodal chassis be issued to the entity responsible for the inspection, maintenance, and/or dispatch of the intermodal chassis. On emissions, we propose legislation limiting the idling time at no more than 15 minutes, backed up by a fine for the offenders. We'd like to see extended periods of operation at the port to ease the truck lines at the gates, and a scheduling or appointment system for port trucks to enter the marine terminal. This legislation aims to move enforcement upstream, focus not so much on the port driver, who is so vulnerable to reprisal or termination if they complain too loudly about long wait times, turn down an unsafe chassis, or refuse to haul an overweight load. Rather, it is the foreign-owned shipping companies and marine terminal operators who should receive the attention of state and local enforcement action, because they control the port operations. They own the equipment and are responsible for its maintenance and repair. And they should be held accountable for sending only safe chassis with legal weight on our roads. In conclusion, the foreign-owned shipping industry through our port system, again, must be held accountable for public safety while operating on Oregon streets and highways, and the quality of air we breathe. Legislation that will hold the foreign-owned shipping companies accountable is not unique to the Port of Portland. It is an issue facing all ports handling cargo containers. Similar legislation, as we'd like you to adopt and that we're proposing, has been signed into law in California, and we submitted the California bills to you, and their Senate Bill 1507 and Assembly Bill 2650. This committee has in its hands the power to recommend proactive safety legislation, protecting the safety of the driving public and our environment. Let's work together to make it happen. Again, thank you for my time here and your consideration of such an important matter. And we'll answer questions later, but I'd like these colleagues to speak because they have personal hands-on, these longshoremen.
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. Excuse me. My name is John Dent. I am Secretary Treasurer, Business Agent of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, ILWU, Local 40, which is a supercargoes and clerks union here in Portland. I represent the 90 men and women who handle the documentation for inbound and outbound cargo moving on ocean-going vessels in the entire Columbia River in the state of Oregon. This includes the inspecting, receiving, and delivering of containers at marine terminals. Workplace safety has always been number one priority for the ILWU. As I'm sure everybody in this room knows, we just reached a tentative agreement with the PMA after some of the most contentious bargaining we've had in our history, and an unprecedented intervention by the federal government after an employer lockout. While the issues of pension and technology and maintenance of benefits received all of the media attention, we also had a committee working full-time in San Francisco on improvements in our safety code, the PCMSC, Pacific Coast Marine Safety Code. One of our priority demands had to do with our employers addressing the concerns over diesel emissions on all vehicles using the marine terminals. And while I haven't yet personally to see the outcome of that bargaining because of the gag order we have on the tentative agreement, I can assure you that the terminal operators have no intention of policing themselves, as evidenced by their lobbying efforts during the recent debate over the Lowenthal Assembly Bill in California, and that's that Bill 26, or Assembly Bill 2650 that Lynn referred to in your packet there. The terminal operators do have the ability to expedite over-the-road trucks in and out of these terminals as we speak. They choose not to. opening up additional inbound and outbound lanes, operating second and third shifts, hiring additional yard personnel are options available today that would improve turnaround times. The only way to force the terminal operators to implement these or other options is to impose the proposed fines on them with this legislation. As experienced in California, when the bill went into effect, changes were made almost overnight so that these operators can avoid paying these fines. I've worked in this industry for over 26 years, mostly as a marine clerk at the container terminals. Some of the worst days I've experienced with respect to workplace exposure were in receiving and delivery lanes and container terminals working under a canopy. I've gotten home with headaches, respiratory congestion, blow my nose for 3 days afterward, and it looks like I've been working in a mine. This is nothing but black particulates coming out. Have my clothes, skin, and hair has been contaminated with what we call, refer to as diesel dust. I can only pray that this long-time exposure has caused only short-term health problems for me. In conclusion, the LWU supports any legislation that serves to improve the workplace environment, the environment of the general population, and the habitats of wildlife that can and do coexist with the marine industry. We have Terminal 6. There's a couple of wildlife refuges out there, and I'm always concerned for that. And that's it. I'd be happy to answer any questions when my colleague finishes here.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Hebert. I'm with the ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Union. I am an advisor to the coast and to the international on maintenance and repair, M&R. I've worked on the waterfront after leaving college. Since December of 1974, I worked in the Machinist Union, the IAM, and I've worked in the ILWU for many, many years. I've been a lead man, foreman, mechanic on the waterfront firsthand, dealt with every part of it. We have four different parts, departments of the ILWU, M&R, maintenance repair. We have the containers and chassis, which is called CEM, container equipment maintenance repair. We have refrigeration repair. We have power equipment repair, and we have cranes. Those are the four different departments. I've been a partial assistant in helping with these different passage of these different bills with Mr. Lowenthal and Gloria Romero. Ms. Romero, we did very well down there because of the problems that we have down in Southern California and along the coast and San Diego up through San Francisco. Southern California, as you know, we're just. Have any of you been on the 710 freeway, you know that it's a disaster. What's happened down there is we had a situation that really sparked the issue, and that's where a judge was going to work in the morning down the 710 freeway, the Long Beach freeway, and a truck was coming in the opposite direction, and a chassis came apart. The equipment came across the divider, killed the judge. That's what sparked the problem, the investigation in the 710 corridor, which is the most dangerous strip of property freeway in the whole world. It's considered the most dangerous. It's devastating what happens on a daily basis there. We started this, and then we decided to work it. Now we're working it up and down the coast, and we're working with the Teamsters. They've done a fantastic job, and it's all about health and safety, nothing else but health and safety. Like you said, 95% of the chassis that are here in this port are owned by the steamship carriers. And those steamship carriers are all foreign conglomerates. They have no idea what's going on. They don't want to be responsible for their chassis. They try to push it on the driver. The driver is not skilled. He's not qualified to know what's going on the open road and what happens to his equipment. He's not certified. He's not educated. He's not trained in that type of work. He's just trained to drive. In Portland, you have the Port of Portland and MTC, Marine Terminals Corporation. They operate the chassis pool down at Terminal 6. You have 500 chassis there, like Len was saying,
and these chassis are all intermingled in this chassis area, and nobody knows what's good and what's bad, what equipment's been inspected. Nobody can ever look at a piece of equipment from on top, walk around and say, okay, here's what's wrong. As we all know, the undercarriage of a chassis, just like a car, you would have to get underneath, use a flashlight, have a creeper, be able to know and understand what you're looking at with axles, with rims, with brake shoes, with bearings, with seals. I mean, I can go on and on and on with frames, slack adjusters, and name it, S-cams. You would have to know what these look like to understand what's wrong with them. You can't have a visual from up on top and know what's wrong. Those are the pieces of equipment that come apart. Or a kingpin. The kingpin is what's held to the truck, the fifth wheel of the truck. If that kingpin's not in proper order, you wouldn't know that unless you had to hit it and get underneath and look at the plate and everything else to see it's not cracked or in bad order. These five different companies that own these chassis pools are trying wholeheartedly to keep from having any kind of legislature that would restrict them and make them responsible to maintain these pieces of equipment in proper working order. At any given time, you have a third of the pool that's in bad order, that's inoperable. But nobody knows that because when you're driving as a driver, you take whatever you see and what you can get out of the terminal. You're not qualified to do it. The ILW has highly certified and qualified mechanics that work on this equipment. We're trained. We have a code that we go by on the waterfront that we have to maintain to do this type of work. We have to have certified welders. We have to have certified brake people, air and brake people, electrical people. We do this type of work. You talk about the conspicuity tape, the reflective tape. That's a law. Most of that is put on so shabby, it's a joke. It falls off. You see it all over the road. That is dangerous flying around the road because that's got a hard backing, a metal backing, and you see so much of that. We have the facilities down here, as we do on all areas, all ports, but they have a fantastic garage down here at Terminal 6 that does all this work, that's with highly skilled men to do the work. And we insist that our skill levels have to be very, very high to accomplish this this goal. If a truck driver comes in and he sees that this piece of equipment that he's trying to get has something wrong with it, like he says, he doesn't know what's good and what's bad. He hooks up to it, he takes off, he doesn't know how to differentiate between good and bad. He's not qualified. There's no system there in the port that dictates how this is to be done. Like I said, I was talking the other day to these gentlemen. I told them that if I was a scrap dealer, I could make a fortune out on the freeway with the different pieces of metal that you find from these chassis that are all over the road. And they're devastating. They're dangerous. There's many accidents that come apart from what's going on with the way they maintain these chassis. The FHWA, the Federal Highway Act, that's done once a year. Most of the time, these chassis don't even get it properly within the time restraints of when they should have it done. They're waiting, waiting, waiting. They don't get it done. The terminals just keep sending the equipment off. It's money, money, money. Forget about the health and safety. It's always last. At the Mahart terminal in New Jersey, we went there in 1999 to see new technology. We went around the world to see at the different ports in Rotterdam, Amsterdam, Europe, went to the Far East. But in Mahart terminal in New Jersey, they have handhelds. And a mechanic has a handheld modem, and what he does is he goes and he takes an inspection, and he gets underneath and uses a flashlight, but everything is handheld. He inputs it into this modem. It goes into the mainframe. He puts that chassis on hold where it cannot leave the facility. It cannot get out the gate unless it's repaired. And the only ones who can release it are the individual who wrote it up that it was bad or the individual who repairs it through the red tag system. The responsibility belongs
to the steamship lines. These are foreign lines, and they continue to take money out of our system but never put anything back, and they don't care what's going on. I, you know, we have to do something about it. We've done that in California. We're going to do it here in Oregon, hopefully with your support, and we're going to do it in Washington also, and we need that support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've already answered some of the questions I'd written down here. Does these chassis leave the port proper? And apparently they do. They deliver containers all of wherever they're headed. Is there, other than the chassis that are there at the port, is there outside trucking firms that bring their own chassis in there to load up containers and take them to wherever they're headed?
Very seldom.
Small percentage.
Yeah, very, very seldom, Mr. Chairman. There is a company, Northwest Container, that has some chassis, but it's such a low percentage. And again, I couldn't speak to their repairs. We didn't look at theirs, but it's less than probably 1 or 2%, I would say, that come in from the outside.
And so containers coming in or leaving the port will be they will move on the highways on these chassis. Most
they have to.
To the largest extent.
Yes. Yeah, they don't have their own mobility. They must be mounted on the chassis.
And there's freight companies and or haulers that are providing their own tractors, and they come in and they...
They show up with their own trucks, yeah, their own tractors.
Right. And whether they're a trucking company or they're
an independent contractor.
Independent owner operator.
And these are the trucks that are sitting there...
Idling.
Is there any other questions? Yes, Jerry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Len, the whole problem is pretty much all in my district. Yeah. So thanks for bringing it to my attention. Certainly the emissions situation is critical, not only because of the health aspects of the people working around the port, but it impacts economic growth throughout the Portland area, and particularly in the Rivergate area. If you get emissions levels at a point where we get in trouble with the federal guidelines, then this could be a real break on bringing other businesses into the Rivergate area. But primarily on the chassis problem, those are really short haul, for the most part, aren't those very short haul situations to rail yards and intermodal situation.
Gary, for the most part, it's the metro area, but they do go to all destinations in Portland and Oregon.
Go
to Medford, Kansas.
But I'm thinking in terms of the percentage that's contained within, most part, within the North Portland Peninsula.
Yes.
Those are never going to have an opportunity to hit any kind of a weight scale, any kind of other inspection, because it's such a... What percentage of those are never going to stay in the close end?
You're probably looking at 80% of the containers that come off of that. Wouldn't you guys agree that 80% right in the metro area? There are waste fields. You're at the terminal right now. Like, for some reason, they're not using them. But the inside the terminals, I believe there's three, are there not, Jen?
There's two that are away from the lanes, and I believe there's six that are in the inbound lanes there.
But again, and it's called expediency to get back on the road and everything else. They're not running over these scale houses or the scales, and could be made available.
When containers are unloaded or loaded, are they weighed? I mean, would you know ahead of time before they went on a chassis whether the container had enough weight in it that it had probably put it overweight?
What you have,
I think you guys.
What I deal with in Southern California all the time is you have a situation where you get a manifest and it tells you, okay, we've got certain cargo in here, and then they tell you we look at it once we find out when a top handler, it comes off the rails or it comes into the terminal with truck, and the top handler goes to pick it up and it can't pick it up. And when you see it can't pick it up and you see the machine tilting forward and you're saying, oh my God, or you have a transtamer and you see a load take an angle. You left to right, you see a load taking an angle. We have no way to understand how it was loaded, how it was secured, if it was lashed properly inside. We have movements all the time of cargo shifting, where we have a situation on the dock where you have a UTR driver, a utility driver driving a what they call a yard boat or UTR on the facility. He makes a turn going 10 miles an hour and the load shifts and flips over. The employer wants to go fire him. I get a call, I go out, I say, no, open the container. Why? I said, open the container. Open the container up, cut the seals, and you see the load has shifted because it wasn't properly loaded. There is no agency that can control that.
Right.
And you have that on your roads every day. But a lot of people don't know that, and how to, the Ohio Patrol, or the state police does that. And in Southern Cal, I took a gentleman from the Ohio Patrol, a liaison between Sacramento and he was a Ohio Patrol officer. I took him in my Suburban, unannounced, put him in the back where I had the shaded windows, took him into all the facilities to see what was going on. He was shocked. He was amazed at what was going on at these facilities and what was coming out of these terminals, at the equipment and the condition it was in. And he and overloads the wrong. You have a manifest saying that you've got cotton goods, and in fact you've got hazardous material that's been shipped into our country that's leaving a terminal to go be dumped somewhere all the time.
I just had, normally, not even normally, it's very hard to cut into that seal. Not hard, but you have to have permission to cut into that seal. The seal is normally not broken until it gets to its destination, and the receiver of the goods comes out and witnesses the cutting of the seal off. So most of these don't get looked at on the vast majority of them. Never get looked on at the inside as to what's in them or what's packed in there.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank all of you for being here this morning. You paint a very frightening picture. And I guess the obvious question that I have is, have you been talking with the obvious people and have failed, and this is your last attempt to correct a problem? Because I would think that there would be many other people that should have been involved in some discussions prior to this.
That's a very good question. Yes, we have. And it all goes back. We met with Bill Wyatt down there, the new port director, who sees reason for doing some of the things he does, but he does not have the authority nor the money to accomplish the purposes. Again, everything you do takes money to do. And the shipping companies, again, these foreign-owned conglomerates, control the money and the flow. And they decide, again, how much time they're going to pay for to do a repair. And if you go over it, they don't pay you. So, yes, we have. And we see this as the last resort, really, to get something done in the name of the public here and everybody's safety.
Thank you. Any other questions? Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned these annual inspections and the failure to complete them in a timely fashion. How often should inspections be done? And does somebody, and has the federal government preempted that, or do we have a right to have a say in how often they should be done?
You have two types of inspections in California, but you have one that's nationally. It's called the FHWA. That's a yearly inspection. With that inspection, you inspect everything, you adjust the brakes, you get underneath the equipment, any repairs that have to be done, you mark everything out. You do the inspection first, and that's separate and apart from repairs. And then you notify the individuals that own and control that chassis, whether it's the terminal or the shipping company that owns that chassis, okay, here's what has to be done. But that doesn't mean it gets done. What happens is that placard on the front, that metal placard, FHWA, has a date on it. You'll find some of those 2 and 3 years old that have not had any repairs, and they're going out on the open road. And now in California, we have what they call the BIT, biennial inspection on the terminal, BIT. And that's done quarterly. And what that is, that's every 3 months, it has to have an inspection done. And that is done by the state of California. That inspection is where a mechanic goes out with his truck, or they either have a bit inspection area that they go to, where they have several hundred chassis go through there every month, or they have a roadability area, or they have trucks they go out in the chassis rows and work on these individual chassis, whether they have a load on it or they're empty. And what they do a full inspection then, and then the repairs are also separate from that. But that has to be accomplished before it leaves, and that's with the California Highway Patrol that monitors that, and they come in and do an inspection. Unannounced, they come in and do an inspection, and if you fail twice, then you have penalties that are levied against you. And we've had several companies that have failed that, and that's why we had to push this bill through Gloria Romero, because she was so upset at what was happening, that there was the abuse of these shippers and terminal operators just to let it go. If you don't get caught, catch me if you can. And that's what happens.
I would add to that, Phil, that, and not as extensive, of course, but every truck driver is responsible to look over that load. But again, he does not have the ability to spot what some of these are, and he doesn't crawl underneath it to inspect it, but he does walk around and checks his lights and brakes, you know, to see it as best he can. Everyone should do that. Every truck driver has that responsibility. But to get the repairs done, and we didn't mean to paint such a bleak picture, but I would add just one more to you. Several years ago, right here, Gary, right out on I-5, a set of duals came off a chassis, and that's two of these big truck tires. The whole thing come off, ran over the medium, smashed through the windshield of an oncoming car, and killed the occupants in the car. Now, those are the serious things that happen with the truck on the road. That's why, I mean, we just feel so important about this legislation, because it's the only way that we're going to be able to make these shipping lines accountable. And that, as Tom and my brother pointed out so well, they have the money, but they're keeping it out of the country. It's time we took some of it back from them and made sure they do the necessary repairs and give our marine terminal operators the money to do it with, and you can give them the authority to do, you know, to accomplish that.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really, really a dumb question, but I ask a lot of those.
Right.
Why don't they just turn the trucks off instead of let them idle?
That's a good question. A truck turning off and on, if you've ever been around diesel trucks, is worse than ever. Idling, it's less intrusive on the environment than actually turning it on and off. Every time you turn that truck on, if you see, they just belch out a big black cloud of smoke.
So you're telling me it's better to let them run than not let them run?
Actually, it is. Then what we're saying is, though, at a limit, if you would limit that to 15 minutes, they'll, you know, again, hopefully they're moving through in that period of time, because every time you move the truck, then the engine's moving more efficient, performing more efficiently, and not spewing out as much of these cancer-causing contaminants.
That's what's happening. Is when the reason why they're so much, they're idling so much, they're moving in the yards. The lines are so long that they have to move every so many feet. So instead of turning it on and off, and plus the wear and tear on that starter motor and everything else, they're moving, but they keep it running. And just set the brake, put it neutral, set the brake. And they move another 15, 20 feet, and they just keep moving through the facility. And then once they get to the gate, then they've got to go to another part of the yard. Whether they're going to go to a flip line, whether they're going to go to a load line, whether they're going to go get a chassis and wait in line for a load. I mean, there are all different types of areas in the yard where they have to go for different things. And then they're idling there. Then what they do, if they get into the yard and they don't have the proper paperwork, they put their rig over in the corner, they put it in park, leave it on, run over to the office, to the trouble window. When they get to the trouble window, they have to deal with paperwork. They run back. It's idling that whole time. They get back inside, and they take off again. Then they go to the different parts of the yard and see if they have any more problems. That's the name of the type of the beast that's down there on the waterfront we could deal with.
Thank you, gentlemen, for the testimony today. Really.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you very much for hearing.
Thank you.
I'd asked Keith Labatt and Ken Armstrong and Greg LaPonte if they would come forward, please.
Can I make a note?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just want to point out that what I passed out to you is a draft of one of the concepts from the Teamsters, and that's the wait time draft, LC 979. We are still waiting. Representative Starr may have it when he arrives this morning, or may still be in council for the other bill draft requested by the Teamsters. So these people have not, no one has seen the other bill draft. Excuse me, so it may be difficult for people to comment. And the other thing is we will be doing those at 11:30 or after when we're doing bill introduction. And that's what I wanted to point out. Thank you.
Go ahead, Keith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland, and I'm in a real envious position right now because I've not seen either bill. I learned about this about Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I understand now that they met with my boss, and I don't really know what was talked about in that meeting. So we don't have a position on these two bills, but I would, we look forward to seeing them. We will fully analyze the legislation. Just remind you, I think many of you have been out to Terminal 6, and we've talked about that operation. What we are is a very small container operation. We have somewhere around in between 3-4% given year market share on the West Coast for containers. The difference between the kind of congestion that you see and the volume that you see at LA, Long Beach, Oakland, Seattle, Tacoma versus Portland is night and day. There is no comparing those operations to Portland. We are primarily an export port. We exist to serve regional Oregon shippers throughout every single legislative district in this state, and those foreign carriers that call at the Port of Portland do so at their convenience, not really because we have a market that requires that they come here. They come here on the trip back to Asia to pick up some cargo to have on a backload. So again, we are a much different animal, and I would it's with that context in mind that we should be reviewing these bills. I realize they got the bills passed in California, and they're just kind of moving up the coast, and that's okay, but we need to be looking at exactly what problems are being solved at Terminal 6 at the Port of Portland by passage of this legislation, and we will be reviewing those bills on that basis.
Thank you, Keith. Go ahead, Ken.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Armstrong. I represent the Oregon Ports Group, which includes the Port of Portland as a member. It also includes Coos Bay, Umatilla, Morrow, Newport, some of the larger ports around the state, and in particular those that are involved in intermodal movements. I'm a little bit troubled by the discussion here this morning. It's clear, as my colleague Mr. Levitt has said, that this is part of a West Coast strategy to make some changes coastwide in the ports industry and in the intermodal industry. However, I would caution the committee, and I think the committee is moving forward appropriately, but I would caution the committee and the legislature from moving too quickly on concepts that have not had any real serious discussion in the state of Oregon. One conversation with Bill Wyatt does not a broad conversation make. And as far as I know, none of my other member ports have been contacted about this issue. I have not been contacted about this issue. I am unaware of what position, if any, the Columbia River Steamship operators have taken on this, what their stance is, what discussions have taken place there. This is a complex issue. There is no question that Oregon's ports are primarily concerned about public safety, and that we are concerned about maintaining competitiveness in a very tight market globally. So I want to pledge to you, as Mr. Levitt has said, that we will be taking a close look at these bills. We stand ready to work with whatever partners come forward to work with us and have discussions on this. That's about as I can't give you any any more intelligent feedback than that, not having seen the drafts, but we will keep an eye on it. We'll be working with you on this issue as it moves forward.
Thank you, Ken. Greg, I ask you to come up because I know that you're involved with truck inspections in your department now throughout the state of Oregon and do have inspection programs that are ongoing. Do you care to comment about it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Greg Delpani. I manage the Motor Carrier Division for the Department of Transportation, and we do have regulatory oversight for the safety programs in the state. I think I can offer a few clarifying comments and maybe even provide some information that will be useful to the committee as you determine how best to address this issue. I just became aware of this discussion myself yesterday. I was unaware of the recently passed California legislation, and I have not reviewed it, although I've been given a copy of it, and I will do so. But I think it might be instructive for the committee to recognize that the Oregon Safety Regulatory Program was established in Oregon Revised Statutes and in Chapter 825, and within that chapter, specifically in 825.252, paragraph 4, the department has been instructed through the adoption of rules, our rulemaking authority, to adopt safety rules and regulations which, insofar as practical, are uniform and comply with their federal counterparts. To facilitate that instruction, we annually readopt the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations Third Administrative Rulemaking Procedure. And by so doing, the state rules are then uniform with their federal counterparts. I think the issue that you've heard discussed here this morning, I won't speak to the idling time issue, that's not my area of expertise, but with regard to the equipment, I do have expertise. In another profession, I spent 10 years working in the steamship intermodal industry as an equipment provider, lessor. In the last 10 years, I spent as a regulator. I can share this perspective with you. There's something unique, I think, about steamship industry. When you think of a motor carrier and you think of someone that you pick up the phone and say you have goods to ship, you're probably expecting a truck driver to arrive with a tractor and a trailer, the full package. And you're simply going to load your freight onto the vehicle and it's going to be transported. Things work a little bit differently at the port, as has been described. The motor carrier is the owner-operator. He owns a tractor, a power vehicle. He arrives and picks up not only the load, the container, but also the chassis, the trailer. And a container and a chassis is different than a truck and trailer in that the container is just the metal box. It looks like the trailer part of the trailer, and it sits on a chassis, and it locks on the chassis, and then it's transported as a chassis and a container. And in this instance, the truck driver's not bringing his chassis with him in the preponderance of the situation. So the chassis and the container are being provided by the shipper. Now, our regulatory authority and oversight applies to motor carriers. It does not apply to shippers. I can't regulate shippers. I regulate motor carriers. So, recognizing that we've adopted the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, the problem then becomes one of interpretation and application of these rules to the situation at hand. Now, this is not a new situation. In fact, in 1999, at the request of the American Trucking Associations and others, a request or a petition was made to initiate a federal rulemaking to address this very issue, to make changes in the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations that would address the kinds of deficiencies you've heard about. The United States Department of Transportation published the rulemaking. They received comments, but they never took any action. It stopped. The kinds of changes that the authors of the petition for rulemaking were seeking were to specific sections in the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, particularly in Part 390, the definition of motor carrier, which specifically says the motor carrier, the only party who can be held responsible for the equipment condition, is the person that's supplying that truck. And when that person is also the owner-operator, it's the owner and the driver, that's that motor carrier that you've heard about, the owner-operator that pulls up to the gates at the port, they are responsible for the equipment condition. Part 396 of the federal regulation speaks to equipment condition and equipment maintenance programs, and there's basically three requirements. You've heard about an annual inspection. There is a requirement for an annual inspection, and evidence of that inspection is supposed to be maintained on the vehicle. There is a requirement that the motor carrier has an organized and sufficient maintenance program. Well, that requirement, under the current construct, falls upon the owner-operator. And what you've heard here is that that's unreasonable because the owner-operator is not providing the piece of equipment that is most oftentimes deficient, the chassis. The shipper is, but there is no regulatory oversight over that shipper's chassis. The responsibility transfers to the owner-operator the moment he puts his tractor underneath it. He's now responsible for the equipment. And then there's a third responsibility in the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, and that is upon the driver. Before the driver operates the vehicle, he or she is supposed to conduct a pre-trip safety inspection to consult any prior pre-trip safety inspections and ascertain if deficiencies noted previously have been repaired. As you can see, though, all the requirements are upon the motor carrier, which in this instance is the owner-operator. So the purpose of this rulemaking, which was not concluded, was to accomplish the intended outcomes by redefining motor carrier and placing those responsibilities where some people feel they reasonably should be. Now, the good news is that a motor carrier publication here just dated this week has announced that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is again considering this very issue, and they're going to undertake a negotiated rulemaking on this very subject, the maintenance of intermodal container chassis and trailers. And they have established the date of January 13, 2003, to receive comments as to whether or not they should continue with this process. The caution I want to give about considering the proper venue, whether we address this situation at all or address it with state legislation as opposed to federal rulemaking, is that there is a danger that if we were to pass legislation through the state legislature, which provided an exemption not provided in the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, we would potentially have a situation in which state law did not conform with federal rules regarding interstate commerce. All of this is interstate commerce. And in that instance, the state of Oregon would run the risk of losing eligibility for federal safety grant dollars through the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, or MCSAP, you may have heard reference to. And that's almost $6 million a biennium. And so the solution, I think it is, other than a Oregon problem, I think it is a national problem, and I suspect the solution is better addressed through a federal rulemaking, the good news is, which is about to transpire. So the opportunity will exist to address it through the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, which we would adopt.
Thank you. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is regarding insurance. When that owner-operator picks up that chassis, does he have additional insurance in case something happens to it? And, you know, his liability exposure increases and he goes on the road with it. I'm sure his insurance company would be aware of there's a liability there, and if something happens, we're going to get sued. Do they get more premium? I mean, how is that handled? Who has the insurance on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, the motor carrier or the owner-operator is required by law, as a condition of fitness to be a motor carrier, to maintain a minimum amount of liability insurance. It's on file with the Department of Transportation. We're automatically made aware of it being filed. We're automatically made aware if it ever were to lapse. We'll suspend authority if it lapses. And the motor carrier, the owner-operator, is at all times responsible.
Just one follow-up. Does the insurance company require him to inspect that a little bit? Some of their rules, you know, or they just don't care what he picks up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, what typically happens, interstate motor carriers have a USDOT number, and as a result of having a USDOT number, They generate a safety rating, and they also generate a safe stat, which is publicly made available, used by insurance company, and it discloses moving violations, vehicle inspections, accidents, et cetera. The difficulty, though, as someone noted this morning, is that these container chassis do not frequently go across a scale operated by my employees. They are very localized transport from the port to a railhead to an intermodal yard, and they are inspected infrequently. And so that safety rating or safe stat may not fully disclose the nature of the equipment that's being used.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Do you have a question, sir?
I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. If the committee doesn't have any objection, we'll take a couple of minute break, and then we'll go on with the rest of the agenda. We are a little bit behind, so we'll keep it to 5 or 10 minutes.
Great.
Thank you.